Okay, let's go ahead and think about getting started.
Okay, this session is entitled The Work of an Evangelist. And as during the break, one of you already quizzically asked, oh, you work. But what I'm handing out is a list of the questions, in essence, that I was given under this heading. And you're going to see that some of them, did everyone get one? Or I have plenty. You're going to see they're asking us to consider more than what I will call just the work of an evangelist, the qualifications, the practical thing, counseling, etc. I think I added two to that list. Basically, we're just going to go down this list and discuss them. I'll make some comments and then open it up for any you might have. And we'll see how that takes it. Okay. The word evangelist we find three times in the New Testament. We find it in Acts chapter 21, verse 8. Acts chapter 21, verse 8, Ephesians 4 and 11, which we talked about yesterday, and 2 Timothy 4 and 5, where Paul tells Timothy to do the work of an evangelist. But the concept of an evangelist is all throughout the New Testament. The Greek word in vines is evangelisti, and it means a messenger of good. So technically, an evangelist is simply a messenger of good. And in most respects, I think the scripture calls all of us to be evangelists. We're all to proclaim the good news. But I think the tenor of this, or the intent of this assignment, is to look at what we might call the office of evangelist as articulated in scriptures. What are some practical things to consider about becoming an evangelist? And several of you have privately visited with me, and I'm sure you've privately visited with others, kind of about that question. What should you consider? It's very common for young men in the church, especially young men as diligent as we have assembled here, to at least consider that and say, well, is that something I should consider or not? I've listed about, I don't know, 8 or 9, 10 things that I think are wise for a person to consider. It is in no way exhaustive, so once I give you mine, I'm going to ask you to add to it. We've got people here that are evangelists. We've got people here who, as elders, have worked with evangelists. We've got people here as young people grew up in evangelist homes, and I think most everybody here has had interface with them, so you have some input. The first thing I put down to ask yourself regarding considering becoming an evangelist is to ask yourself, why do you want to be an evangelist? Now, as I prepared this lesson, I kind of had to make a choice. I can be kind of blunt and tell you exactly what I'm thinking, or I can be politically correct and you can read between the lines. It won't surprise you that I probably lean toward the first. And so if I have to turn off this mic, I will. And I don't mean to say anything that's inappropriate. You never intend to do that. You just sometimes do. But I do have some very strong feelings about it. Why do you want to be an evangelist? One of the concerns that I warn young men about in terms of thinking about becoming an evangelist is it seems to me in some minds there is a glorification of the office of evangelist that's inappropriate. We don't have, in mutual ministry, the pastor system or the one-man minister system, and evangelists are not to be that. But I do concern myself that sometimes, even within our brotherhood, there is a glorification of the evangelist more so than in other religious sects who have pastors and one-located preachers where maybe the glorification goes there. Well, that's an inappropriate depository of the glorification. I also think the evangelist is an inappropriate. Now, respect, that's one thing. Glorification. And so I caution you, I caution anybody, if you're considering or just thinking about it, make sure you want to do it for the right reason. And the right reason can be stated in different words, but it's, you see it, you might have a gift, and that might be the best way for you to serve the Lord. and the brotherhood by being an evangelist. Number two, is that your talent or is it the best way for you to serve? Because of the glorification or maybe the adulation aspect that some people connotate with the office of evangelist, sometimes I think people jump toward that without really assessing their gifts as to is that the best way they could serve. I'm convinced that there are men who are young men who have striven to be evangelists who with maybe a little more reflection would have concluded their gift maybe is more as being an elder, or as being a deacon, or whatever. A farmer. It came up yesterday, you know. There is no way of serving the Lord that's better than another way of serving the Lord. The key is to serve the Lord. Number three is being an evangelist where you are most needed. You might have all the talents to be an evangelist, but maybe that's not where the brotherhood or your local area or congregation needs you most. Number four, do you enjoy people? Do you enjoy people? If you don't, do everybody a favor and find something else. The counter of that is equally important. Do people enjoy you? If they don't, do us all a favor and do yourself a favor. And I don't really mean to be flippant with those two. Some people just enjoy being by themselves more than others. Well, I enjoy being by myself. But you're going to be with people all the time, well, a high percentage of time. You may be on the road and be in people's homes where you've got to morph into whatever fits into their culture that isn't your culture. If you can't do that, it's going to be a problem. I put letters by these, so I don't know what number this is. It looks like maybe six. Are you a self-starter? If you're not a self-starter, you're probably better off doing something else. And it's nothing wrong with not being a self-starter. You know, some of us need to have to be there at a certain time and get off at a certain time to get things done. That other people can be self-starters. Now, everyone considers that they're probably a self-starter. The reality is, though, that probably more aren't than are. Are you willing to work as you do it? And by work, I mean secular. Would you be willing to have a secular job to augment your evangelistic role? I put that one in there because I think it's a checkpoint to make sure that the reason we choose to do this is not so that we are supported. And I don't imply by that, and you know I don't imply by that, that there's anything wrong with evangelists being supported. I do imply by that that that's the wrong reason. Ask yourself, what is your temperament? Do you have the temperament for it? Do you have a temperament that allow you to take adulation and not let it go to your head? Or allow you to get discouraged quickly. The last one I put on this list, and I just quit writing after a while, what are your financial expectations? What are they? And I really don't care what your expectations are. But some of you are going to feel a little bit like you're not making it if you don't make over X dollars a year, and others of you would need 2X dollars and so forth. Well, I hope you don't get rich as an evangelist. I hope you're provided for if that occurs. It seems to me in our brotherhood we're kind of in a cycle. Maybe we're on the downside of a cycle too. 50, 60, 70 years ago, our evangelists were compensated very poorly. I won't mention names, but none of these incidents have to do with my father. An evangelist said he went and preached one Sunday, and in order to get home that night, he was banking on whatever little money they would give him to buy gas. Well, as his luck would, they paid him with 2 chickens. And he didn't have gas to get home. A farmer gave him some. What I think has happened is, in appropriately, in response to that, our brotherhood has gone the other way. And I'm not saying anybody is overpaid, but your parents' age or my parents' age, I think, have been very sensitive to trying to correct that wrong. And it seems like sometimes that pendulum, it's hard to get that pendulum in the middle. So those were some I came up with. Why do you want to do it? Is that the best way for you to really serve? Is that where you're most needed? Do you enjoy people? Do people enjoy you? Are you a self-starter? Are you willing to work as you do it? What is your temperament? What are your financial expectations? Would anyone like to add a few to that? And again, I know there are many to add to that. Those are just some of my thoughts that I would suggest you consider. Richard? You have a wife and a family. Are they on board? Absolutely. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but that's true no matter what office it is. But it's probably maybe even more true, a little more true of an evangelist, because it does put a greater load on the wife, maybe than even an elder or deacon, just because of the being away. Anybody else want to add some things that we would tell young men? And it wouldn't necessarily be young men. Sometimes it's retired men that are considering doing it. Ask them to consider. Okay? What are the qualifications of an evangelist? And I'm going to pause to let this get clear to the back. Maybe you can split them up. This isn't a definitive list. In fact, as I go through this, I'm going to be adding some scripture to it. But there isn't a list in the scripture for qualifications for evangelists. In the same sense, there are lists for deacons and elders. I can't turn to 1 Timothy 3 or any passage 3 and say, well, those are the qualifications. But you will notice you get those sheets, and I'm going to add some scripture to them, that a preponderance of them are taken from the books of Timothy and Titus. Timothy and Titus seem to function as evangelists, and so as Paul wrote to them, he gave some instructions on how they should be. And that's about as close as we can get, about as good as I can get, to the qualifications for an evangelist. A striking difference between a qualification for an evangelist and an elder and a deacon is marriage and children. And I could probably say in the spirit of these qualifications, that's about the only two differences. But those are our two differences. What I'm going to do is somewhat briefly skim through. I'm going to start in 1 Timothy chapter 1, skim through and look at some verses that give us these qualifications before we look at the work. And I appreciate and welcome your comments. As we go through this. This will be a little bit like Tom did Ecclesiastes, only it'll be obviously much quicker. And I will be adding some verses to the ones that you got. The first one, let me talk about the top. I don't know where I first heard this, but I've always really liked it. There's more to being an evangelist than wanting to. And I put that up there because it seems to me sometimes congregations feel a need to be evangelistic. And they equate that with sending money to an evangelist. Well, that's a part of it. But I don't think congregations should soothe their consciences for lack of evangelism by sending money to an evangelist. An evangelist should augment a congregation's activity, not replace it or take the place of it. As it's been said, sometimes it's easier to go across the country or across the ocean than it is across the street. When we're talking about the scripture. Well, I think it's appropriate to do both. But I go to some congregation, and if you ask them, well, are you evangelizing? Well, what they'll say to me is, yeah, we're sending money, and they'll list 4 different evangelists. Well, that's sort of right, but it's only a small piece of the puzzle, as I see it. And with that attitude, sometimes congregations, I think, feel that if a person wants to be an evangelist, they have almost a duty to make them an evangelist. And I couldn't disagree with that more. I think if a man's willing and qualified and can do the work and has the right temperament, the attitude, and sound doctrine, go for it. That's not my problem. But sometimes congregations have such a hunger and thirst to feel like they're doing something evangelistic that they maybe make poor decisions on who and when and how they send people out. Anybody want to make a comment on that? That's a bit of a hot potato. Okay. Wisdom provision. The first passage, I'm not going to turn to it, is Acts 16 and 2 you see on that sheet. That's when Timothy was first, one of the early mentions of Timothy. And one of the things that is said about him is he was well reported of by the brethren. Well, I think it just goes without saying. Any Christian should be well reported of by the brethren. But certainly if you're going to be doing the work and representing the Lord in this capacity, you would want someone who is well reported of by the brethren. 1 Timothy chapter 1, a couple of verses that aren't on there. Verse 3. I besought thee to abide still at Ephesus, when I went to Macedonia, that thou mightest charge some that they teach no other doctrine. Timothy is being instructed to charge people not to teach any other doctrine. This dovetails exactly with what Brother Kenny was talking about in false doctrine. Timothy as an evangelist was to be able to do that. I consider that to be a qualification. Verse 18. This charge I commit unto you, Timothy, according to the prophecies which went before on thee, that thou by them mightest war a good warfare. An evangelist has to war a good warfare. Verse 19. Holding faith and a good conscience. Holding the faith and a good conscience. An evangelist must do that. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15. But if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of truth. An evangelist is supposed to know how to behave himself in the house of God. I take that to mean to do it with reverence, to do it with respect, and do it in a way that glorifies and praises God. Sounds academic, doesn't it? Or sounds elementary, maybe I should say. But I find it there. Chapter 4, verse 6. If thou put the brethren in remembrance of these things, thou shalt be a good minister of Jesus Christ. An evangelist is to put the brethren in remembrance of things. Peter, in writing his letters, indicated that putting them in remembrance was one of his goals. Verse 12. Let no man despise thy youth, but be thou an example. Okay, I talked about that, I think, last night in another context. An evangelist is to be an example. If you're not an example of a good Christian, then you're not going to be effective as an evangelist. I'm not talking about being perfect. Verse 13, till I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, and to doctrine. As Kenny so well said last hour, if you don't do it, how can you ask other people to do it? Verse 15, meditate upon these things and give yourself wholly to them. An evangelist is to have the element of not only studying the word, but meditating, gurgitating, chewing it. Verse 16, take heed unto yourself and to the doctrine and continue in them. We have the continuation in the doctrine. Chapter 5, verse 1. And somebody, I think maybe John, asked about this last night in a different sense. Rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father. And in this particular verse, as I said last night, I take elder to be an older person. Younger people are to treat. Timothy was younger than many of the people he was going to maybe have to rebuke. But he was to do it with honor. But he was still to do it. I don't think this means don't rebuke them. I think that means entreat them as a, with honor. if it has to be done. Because to say that we can never bring a correction against someone who happens to be older than us would, I think, violate other scriptures. We'll talk about that in a moment. Chapter 5, verses 19 and 20. And here I think the term elder is used differently. I think now in verse 19, in the context of these verses, we are talking about the office of elder. Verse 19, against an elder receive not an accusation, but before two or three witnesses. And I think you're familiar that in the Roman arena, when a charge was brought against somebody, there needed to be multiple witnesses. That's just a good practice. Them that sin rebuke before all others, that others may fear. Now that might be more work than a qualification, but an evangelist needs to be able to do that. So it in a sense is both a qualification and a work. There are some people that simply would not want to do that or wouldn't be comfortable doing that. I don't know if you ever get comfortable doing that, but discipline and correction is a uncomfortable necessity, I think, would be the way I would like to say it. Chapter 6, verse 2. And they having believing masters, let them not despise them because they are brethren, but rather do service because they are faithful, partakers of benefit. These things teach and exhort. An evangelist is to be able to teach and exhort those things. Chapter 6 of 1 Timothy verses 6 through 11, there's a whole list of things that are inappropriate conduct. And then if you'll notice in verse verse 11, flee these things. So just look at the things he's been talking about in the preceding verses, and those are inappropriate for an evangelist. Thank you, Wade. Verse 12, fight the good fight, lay hold of eternal life. Self-explanatory, I hope. Verse 17, there's charge those that are rich in this world. There will be a need to put materialism in its proper perspective. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 8, be not thou therefore ashamed of the testimony of our Lord. Don't be ashamed of what you're taking to the public. Verse 13, hold fast the form of sound words which thou hast heard of me. Chapter 2, verse 2, and these things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit to faithful men. There's the passing on of the gospel to faithful men. Verse 3, thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier. An evangelist should be able to endure hardship. That may be an advantage some of our previous generations have had over my generation and your generation. And I'm not saying that I'm glad some of our older evangelists and some of them have passed had hard times, but there is a learning process and a weaning out process that only comes in the crucible of life. And most of us have had it physically probably better than maybe is sometimes good for us. Having said that, I'm glad we're blessed. It's just a little bit of a dichotomy to me. Verse 14, of these things put them in remembrance. We've already had that. Verses 24 and 25, and the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men. I put that a little bit alongside when an elder is not to be a striker. To be gentle unto all men, apt to teach, patience, meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves. Chapter 4, the first few verses, give some instruction. And then Paul, in verse 5, one of the three times the word evangelist is used, says, but watch thou in all things, endure afflictions, do the work of an evangelist, make full proof of thy ministry. Two more. Titus chapter 1, verse 5. There is the setting and order of all things. An evangelist has to have the ability to do that. And in chapter 2, verse 1. Speak thou the things which become sound doctrine. The setting and order is part of the work. And in chapter 2, verse 15, famous. These things speak and exhort and rebuke with all authority. Let no man despise it, your youth. So I see those, and I'm sure you can go through those books and find other qualifications of an evangelist, but I think that gives us a thumbnail sketch. Now, if you look at the sheet I handed out to you, I listed some others that maybe are intertwined with the ones I just rattled off, but I want to spend just a moment talking about those, because I don't think Paul addressed them, and I'm getting into areas of my judgment here, okay? For instance, hell. I'm not going to say that it's unscriptural for an unhealthy man to be an evangelist. But I think, if at all possible, because of the rigors of various aspects of it, a man in good health is going to have be able to do more, quite possibly. So you ought to consider your health, and you ought to consider the health of your family. Maybe you have a mate or a child that needs extra care that would cause your being away from them, even for short periods of time. I've known of men who wanted to be evangelists, who traveled with evangelists, and because of the emotional states of some in their family, declined. And some of those men are now elders and performing very well. And I applaud them for having their priorities straight. Sometimes we get in our minds, and I think especially as young people, that to serve as evangelist is the ultimate. I don't view it that way. Serving God is the ultimate, and there are a plethora of ways to serve God. So, it's an honorable way to serve God, but I don't think it's any higher than an elder. If you want my personal opinion, having been both, being an elder is more difficult than being an evangelist. The difficulties are different, but elders have to stay there day in and day out and deal with the problems and resolve the problems in the same people day in and day out. That is somewhat of a different manifest. Humility. And if I get time, we're going to talk about some of the dangers that I think evangelists face, and I'm not talking about traffic accidents. But pride is one of them. Pride is one of them. Sometimes pride is self-imposed, and sometimes I think pride in evangelists is externally imposed, because there is the line between respect and adulation is very fragile. And I don't always know how to draw it, I'll be honest with you. And that's all I want to say. Willingness to adapt. An evangelist is going to find himself in all different kinds of situations. He's probably going to find himself in all different kinds of homes. He's going to be eating all different kinds of meals. He may be eating food that he doesn't even know what it is. He may pray before he eats and then pray again after he eats. And I've never had any real bad experiences there. And I don't mean that. But some people, that's just not going to be your cup of tea. Well, you can sit there and say, well, now all evangelists don't have to travel. Well, that's true. But I don't know of any that aren't going to be sent. And you know your psyche. It's just part of it. It's just absolutely part of it. Optimistic. An evangelist is often going into different congregations over a period of time. The last thing that congregation needs is a sourpuss coming in and tell them how bad things are. Now, sometimes things are bad. And sometimes you have to tell them they're bad. You tell them with a smile, because you're there to build them up. I hate to go someplace and the people feel worse after I've been there. It's happened, but it's not my goal. And some people are just not optimistic people. They're kind of pessimistic. Studious. Well, this is true of all Christians, but I know a lot of good Christians that study is not their cup of tea. You know, to open up a book for some of them is like a pillow for me. It means go to sleep. Well, an evangelist is going to need to be someone who is studious, I think. Otherwise, I don't know how you're going to do the things Paul asked Timothy and Titus to do that I just recounted. Versatile. That's a little bit like adaptable. You know, Paul's, you know, went be all things to all men. Well, that doesn't mean be a sinner, but it does mean adaptable. You know, when I'm in somebody's home and they love to hunt, well, hunting's important to me. When I'm in somebody's home and they like NASCAR, then NASCAR is important to me. Neither one of those are naturally my cup of tea, but it's all part of people skills and dealing with it. Perseverance, Any of you that have secular jobs know that if you were rich, you would have quit many times. I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, when I was doing secular work, I would probably quit 5 times a year if I hadn't had a mortgage and a family to feed. And I didn't have a bad job. Well, evangelists may not quit, but what happens or what can happen is they can quit without quitting. Okay? You may have seen people in your workplace that are still taking a paycheck, but they quit. And that's called quitting before you quit. Well, an evangelist being a self-starter and sometimes being somewhat unsupervised can quit without quitting. I hope that doesn't happen because I don't think that pleases God. But perseverance is a key there. And I think it was Richard, somebody mentioned a willing family and a willing wife. If you have a family, and if you are married, and if you have children, factor them in. Factor them in. I was not an evangelist until my children were well into their teen, maybe even late teen years. I kind of forget exactly. And I don't regret that for one iota. Now, I'm not going to sit up here and tell you that was my grand plan. Wait till Brandon gets to be 17 and Shane 14. I wasn't even on my radar screen. In hindsight, I'm awfully glad I did it that way. And I'm not being critical of people that take another course. I've been asked to give you my opinion, so I will give it to you. If you're going to have children, be involved appropriately in the raising of the children. And I don't mean this at all critical of my dad, because I have a lot of respect for my dad, but I was largely raised by my mom. And dad would be gone for 5 to 7 weeks at a time. He'd come home for 1 or 2 weeks, and then he'd be gone for 5 to 7 weeks at a time. In some family situations, that will work. You can judge whether it worked in ours or not. But in many family situations, that would be an absolute disaster. The way we use our evangelists has changed a little bit over the last 50 years. I accept that. But there's still, it still puts some real stress on that family unit. I'm convinced undyingly of that. Anybody have a comment or a question you would like to make on that segment about the qualifications or any of those practical issues that I listed out there for you to think about? Grant? Getting what? Yes. If there's any good congregations left? Yeah, sometimes I feel that way, and when I start feeling that way, I come to Bloomfield. No, I don't feel that way. My experience is congregations are just so much alike, it's not laughable, it's just humorous. They've got strong people, weak people, same problem, same girl, different dress. But one of the things you do find is that people in the congregation will often share with the evangelist things they don't even share with their elders. And that's partly because they're more comfortable seeing someone they don't see every week. A couple of congregations that I go to, the elders joke, and after I've been there a week, they come and say, well, what's going on in our congregation? And they don't really mean that, but sometimes you'll pick up things. But you could get jaded. That could be a discouraging thing. That's not been a problem that I've really felt for me personally, but it could be. If you can't take that, it's going to get you down. It will get you down. But there are equal joys to balance that out also. Anybody else care to make a comment or ask a question on anything that I've touched on so far? Yes, Charles. Okay, the question is, do I think there's an optimum age, if you will, for a man to start being an evangelist, or is it something that can just happen at any age in life? Well, the reality tells us it can happen at any age in life. I'd say over 20. I don't know of too many under 20. But I do have some feelings about that and some preferences. And I've shared them with some of you privately because some of you have come and asked me. Some have listened, some haven't. But what I'm going to say is not a rule. It's just if you ask me an optimum. And it gets a little bit into question number 4, but we'll go back. I think a young man ought to get all the education he can. No, let me rephrase that. A young man should get all the education he can stand. Okay? You can get too much education and start messing with your brain. But then you start thinking you're too smart. But my recommendation is for a young man to get as much education as he can, and I would certainly recommend, if possible, for that to include college. And I say that not because of what you learn in college, because I think in college, more important than what you learn is you learn how to learn. And that will follow you. My undergraduate degree is microbiology and biochemistry. Every evangelist ought to have an undergraduate degree in those two things. It's essential. No. But you learn how to go to the library and dig it out, and some people learn that on their own. You know. But I think it is helpful. So I would say that. My personal belief is that a young man will do himself and his family well if he gets settled for a period of time. Maybe when you get out of college, you're married, maybe you aren't. I've told young men, my advice is get your degree or whatever it is, get yourself a job, work that job for 5 or 6 years. When you turn 30, come back, and if you still want to do it, then let's talk. Now, that's not in the Bible. It is not the only way to do it. It's not the way my dad did it. It's not the way several of the evangelists looking at me right now did it. And that doesn't mean that the way they did it was wrong. I just think there is some real benefit in getting some stability to your life and sorting out who you're going to marry and if you're going to have kids and then having something to fall back on. Maybe you end up at 30 being an evangelist, and after 2 years it's not working or you don't like it. It's nice to fall back. When you're 40 and 50, you know, people think, well, I can go out and get a job for $50,000 when I'm 50. Well, if you haven't had some work experience, you're kidding yourself. Usually. I mean, who wants to hire a 50-year-old man with no secular work experience? Well, you can get a commission job selling insurance, and that's an honorable work. But it's hard work. Now, that is not the only way it will work, and we've got many successful evangelists who've done it other ways. I was asked to give my opinion. That, I think, is a pretty good formula. It's not exactly the way I did it. It took me a long time to get stable, I guess. Probably never did. But my opinion, we and congregations get in a hurry. We get in a hurry. And sometimes we do ourselves and the brotherhood a disservice when we get into too much of a hurry. Do you have a comment on that, Charles? Well, I'm not an expert either. And you know, it's like saying, well, what's the ideal life plan? Well, there's no ideal. But I think there are some principles that work best that just make some common sense to me. You know, it's always been interesting to me that, and I know the qualifications are different, but we're much more comfortable putting an evangelist in at a much younger age than we would a deacon or an elder. And I know there are differences. I've just always found that to be a curious thing. Anybody else have a comment on that or a question? Tom.
I think it goes along with your point about encouraging someone eventually to be willing to work. Part of being able to work is
Yeah, I think if you've got some experience that gives you a fallback position, that's good. That's good. My dad was a carpenter, and that was his fallback position. When he had, I don't know if I'd call it a nervous breakdown, but I think that's about what it was. He then got out of the work and did carpentry construction work for 10 years, and then he went back into the work. But he had a fallback position. I'm not saying he planned it. I don't know if he planned it. He just had it. And he was working with this congregation part of the time. When he was doing that construction work, he was still an evangelist, had the oversight down here, if I remember correctly. It was a positive thing for our family. The work of an evangelist. Let me go through this. I think not, I don't want to rush to it, but I want to give them to you. Obviously, and I've got 6 points down here, an evangelist is to evangelize. And that's, I hope we can all agree on that one. But so is everybody else, is to evangelize. You don't have, in one sense, we're all evangelists, but not in terms of the office. Number two that I wrote down, an evangelist can be involved in establishing new congregations. One of the works is to establish, Paul told Titus to set things in order in Crete, the establishment of new congregations. Number three, there is the continuing to establish or strengthen existing congregations. I see that evangelists work to be on two fronts, on the frontier and at the home line. And I think they're both equally valid places for an evangelist to work. And, well, I'll go back to that. Evangelist, one of the works of an evangelist is to appoint officers in congregations. We have that example of Timothy and Titus. They did that. Here disputes against elders. We saw that in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 19 and 20. Very unpleasant thing to do, and thankfully a very seldom needed thing, but it is part of the checks and balances. And then I wrote down number 6, which may simply be a regurgitation of some of the others, the setting in order both of old and new congregations. And things go in cycles. 50 years ago, I think the evangelist, and I may be wrong, but there seemed to be a large emphasis on working with established congregations 50, 70 years ago. And then people said, well, there's more to being an evangelist than that, so we need to go out to new frontiers. And so we've seen more of that in the last few decades. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's a positive thing, as long as we keep the balance. I remember as a young teenager, though, people would almost make fun of the evangelists who worked largely with existing congregations, and they would use terms like the fried chicken circuit. I find that extremely offensive, because it, I think, was belittling to men who are actually doing the work of the evangelist. Not the only work of an evangelist, but work of an evangelist. The point I'm trying to make is, both are valuable work. And some people are more suited for one than the other. Some people can do some of both. But I think there is a function in both arenas, in new congregations, in pioneer areas, and there is the strengthening and establishing of existing congregations. I go to some small congregations who very limited resources, and you all visit them. And I kind of admire them, and I don't admire them when they send like 80 or 90% of their monies 1,000 miles away. I mean, that's a good work, but my concern is, and I sometimes, if they ask me, will tell them, you've got to take care of home, or pretty soon there's nothing to send. And so I think it's a balance for congregation to evangelize locally, as well as you have opportunity to support evangelism from a distance away. My opinion. Okay, Thomas? Well, Thomas's comment was, in Acts we see oftentimes men traveling together, and Thomas says he doesn't see as much of that today. I think it's good in many situations for men to work together. There's a variety of reasons for that, helping self-start each other, iron sharpening iron, as we talked about last night. There are some times when maybe it's not the best use of two people's time when one person could do the job. I think there is a judgment issue there. In Acts, though, the travel was probably longer in duration and more laborious in its nature. But I see some real advantages to men working together. I particularly am becoming more appreciative of, and if we have time we'll talk about it, multiple evangelists in an evangelistic oversight situation. Two heads better than one. Do I think that's scripturally essential? No. But I see some wisdom in that. I So I don't think it's a requirement, but I think there are, depending upon the personalities of the people and the work involved, there can be some real advantages to that. Anybody want to comment or elucidate on that a little bit more? Having said that, I'm not real good at that, and I don't know why. Some guys just travel together and really enjoy it. I work at the enjoying it part, and I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just my habit. It may just be my habit. But boy, there's been lots of times when I was glad to have another evangelist to counsel with and consult. But it's so different now. And I know I can't get specific, but I've been in situations where I needed counsel from other evangelists, right? You know, send one email to four guys, and the next day I got that counsel back. Well, that's not the same as having them with me, but it's a lot different than it was 50 years ago when you didn't have that access. Anybody else? Comment or a question? Okay, let's look at number 5. I found this. I had to smile when I read it. And I'm not making fun of the question. Some evangelists begin with what appear to be very little promise of success. They have poor speaking ability and poor people skills. What would encourage someone to think they can do the work of an evangelist with poor speaking skills and poor people skills? Deep meaning. I mean, those are two pretty crucial things. Now, can person improve those things? Sure. But just at face value, if you don't get along with people and can't communicate, there's probably another way you can serve the Lord. But you can maybe enhance those skills, to some extent. And I didn't raise my hand in this sense. Which class was on talents? Is that you? Wade? I don't know. You know, and I thought that was a very, very good class. But, you know, there are just some talents. I don't know how to teach some people. And there's some talents you're not going to be able to teach me. I just don't have what it takes. So that's part of coming to grips with it. But, you know, there are things. This people skill thing, I'm going to go back and plug my secular work comment a little bit. For me personally, what little people skills I have, I learned in the secular workplace. And I spent about 12 years in sales and marketing. And, you know, they send you to course after course, and some of it's a bunch of hooey, but you do pick up some things about reading people and stuff. Anything you can do to pick up things that will enhance your people skills, even if it's just retail sales at Kmart, those things can be invaluable. You know, it's a people activity. You know, they would teach you how to go into a person's office and assess what their likes and dislikes were by what's hanging on the wall. Well, you go into a person's home to have an initial Bible study. You pick up on what are they like. What, you know, that means a lot to people. And it's not manipulation. It's just being interested in those people. So I think there are some things that a person can do to enhance their speaking ability and people skills, but those are absolutely two crucial things for an evangelist. I mean, I just don't know where you start without either one of those. What advice would you give someone considering becoming an evangelist? I think I've kind of touched on that in number 1. So we may talk a little bit more about that. I would like to drop down to number 8 because number 7 is really questions about counseling, which are appropriate for an evangelist but not exclusive to an evangelist. So we'll come back to that and spend time on that as time allows. Number 8. What issues would you discuss with a woman you are considering marrying if you are considering evangelistic work? Well, let me ask you. What do you want to talk about a prospective wife if you're seriously considering being an evangelist? Well, then you better not do it. No, you want to talk to her about, can she handle you being gone a little bit? You would be amazed. My wife, her name's Donna. She is absolutely floored by the number of women that have never been, they've been married 20, 30, 40 years, have never spent a night away from their husband. I mean, and she's done that all her married life, and that's one of the keys to our marriage. You know, if I'm home very long, she'll say, "Where's your calendar? You ought to be going somewhere, shouldn't you?" I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek. Her and I kid about this. But there are some women that just, and when you're away, even if it's just for a four-day weekend or a week, the wife's got the responsibility of the kids. If materialism is important to the woman, she needs to know that you're probably not looking at a $100,000 job. You have to go to a denomination to get that. And I would caution you, both the bride and the groom in this scenario, to be realistic and not idealistic. What often happens is you're in love and all this. Oh, that'll be no problem. I love you. Well, let's get married out. That's not... Now, sometimes that changes in the laundry stack. So just be circumspect. And again, I'm back to why I think it's good to let a little time to get that home settled and find out what to do. Is it wrong to enter into it when you're 22 or 23? No, it's not wrong. Not at all. I'm just trying to give you my advice as to how to maximize your efficiency. And there is high burnout in this job. And I would rather a man spend his 40 to 65 years very productive than to burn out by the time he's 45. It'd be nice to go from 20 to 65 and never have it, but there is burnout. It's a church work, whether it's evangelist, elder, whatever, church work is one of the most highest burnout jobs by statistics. Because you care. You're passionate about it. And it hurts you when things don't go right. It hurts you when people leave the church, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's by definition a high burnout. High burnout. Anyone want to comment on issues you should discuss with a woman you're considering marrying? That wasn't an issue for me because it wasn't even in my mind when we got married. When I decided I'd like to do this, I asked Donna what she thought of it, and she only had one question. Do I have to travel with you? And I said, only when you want to. And after that, she said, that's all. She was fine with it. But by then, she was a 40-year-old woman that had maybe some maturity that she wouldn't have had when we first got married. Okay, number 9. How can congregations assist in making visits from an evangelist more effective? Give input to the evangelist. Give input in terms of topics and have elders or somebody have some things that would be of best benefit to the congregation for that evangelist to do during the day. That could be a list of people that need to be visited or need to be encouraged, especially if it's the first time or two that an evangelist has been there. He's not going to know the lay of the land. Now, when Tom or Rick goes to a congregation that they've been to every year for the last 15 years, they know the people. They can kind of... But plan it. Just plan the activities. Not strangling him, but I think any good evangelist will welcome some direction. Who needs to be visited? What are the areas that I can help in? Let the evangelist help as much as they can. That was my initial comment. Does anybody? On the other end, as people in congregation, what can we evangelists do to help make our visits more productive? Let me ask you that way. What would you like to see evangelists do that maybe you don't always see them do? Kind of a question and answer rather than a sermon? Or maybe even apart from it. Yeah. Sometimes I will do a whole night of have the congregation give me questions in advance and we'll just discuss it. And it's an opportunity. But you could have that in the morning for the ladies or maybe sometimes a congregation have a lot of men that work at night. You could have a session in the morning for them. And this is not a criticism. If it's a criticism, it's directed at myself as much as anybody else. But, you know, an evangelist, it's okay to give them something to do before 7:30 at night. It's acceptable. You know, they need some time to gather their thoughts and do things, but let's use them. Let's use them. Well, work them's right, but it sounded kind of crude. And they would welcome that. Because when you go into a community, you're usually staying in someone's home. I feel the obligation to get out of the house, to get out from under the toe of the woman. Not that they are kicking me out. They just have their routine. Okay. Have a time to ask questions and have a give and take discussion. That's good. Anybody else have a thought that maybe we could use our evangelists when they're with us more effectively? Well, you think about it. Because I'm sure we could improve. Brandon? That's an interesting comment. I agree with you, but I'm uncomfortable with it. And I'll only tell you, I think it's good to share good news. Obviously there are confidentialities that have to remain that, and you weren't implying that. But yeah, that can uplift, especially congregations that are maybe a little isolated geographically that don't get the mix. That's a thought. Yeah. Well, that's why when we get the gospel message, we start with page 4 and read backwards. Because we're most interested in pages 3 and 4. Now that's a generalization, but I bet that's true. And then if we have time, we'll read page 1. But we're interested. We are interested. Now, obviously there's a fine line between interest and nosy. But I think there can be some upbuild. Yeah. Thank you, Brandon. Dan? Yeah. Well, I think there has been some changes. I think, historically speaking, evangelists did DBSs and that kind of stuff, too. They sometimes would last longer than they do now. But the baptism is a good point. I used to go back and reread some of those old gospel minutes, Mission Messenger, and Wilford Landis would come in and he'd baptize 10 people in 2 weeks, and Tom Dennis would be there in the spring and he'd baptize 15 people in 2 weeks. And I thought, goodness gracious, I need to get some sermons like they got. They're doing something like... But what people would do would save them up until the evangelist got there. Because there was a mindset among some congregations that you needed to be an evangelist to baptize. Now, I hope nobody feels that way. We need to baptize people as soon as they're ready. So you don't have that flood. So there's been some changes like that, yeah. Travel has made it different. Evangelists would stay for 2 weeks because they'd come by train maybe. It would take them a long time to get there. Now, you're within 10 hours of about anywhere you need to go. So that's different. There's been a decrease in the week-long meetings, and they've gone to weekend meetings. And I think some of that's due to people getting too busy with their evening, but some of it's due to travel, and we get here quicker. But yeah, there's been some changes. Some of you that are even older than me can speak to some of the changes you've seen, but yeah, there are definitely changes. In that sense. Well, that's going to depend upon who the evangelist is, to be honest with you, but I know what the thought process there is, that that's not the most effective way to use an evangelist. I tend to not necessarily accept that, per se. Because now we're back to Tom's comment. What's more important than teaching our young people? And I think when an evangelist sometimes is doing a VBS, it can instill in those young people how important the congregation feels those young people are. I've had some VBSs where I would teach the adults rather than the teenagers. And then the congregation would come back and say, no, we want you to teach the teenagers because we want them to feel that they're the most important thing. It comes back to keeping our children. So no, I don't really share the view that that's necessarily an inappropriate. Now, for that to be about a predominance of what an evangelist does, it might not be the best use of his time. Well, I sure remember as a youngster really feeling neat when the evangelist would come to town and we'd have, it was just, even if they said the same things that my elders would say or other people, it was just a special treat. With one exception, and I've told him this face to face so I could say it. When Tom Dennis would come and do it, I just hid under the pew. I mean, big straight back and booming voice, you know, it just scared me as a little kid, but it was a treat. And now I just really appreciate Tom. But I remember those times. And those of you that are 40 and above that grew up in the church, you remember those times. So I don't necessarily share the feeling that that's necessarily an inappropriate use. The congregations that I see growing have one thing in common. They keep their young people. If you were to ask me the one single thing that causes congregations to grow, and I'm not saying it should be this way, the congregations that grow that I go to are the ones that keep their young people. So anything we do and any time we spend on the 20 and below age group, it's hard for me to criticize that. Now, could we bring others in? Sure. But the congregations that are dying away, for want of a better expression, are the ones that have not done a good job with their young people. For whatever reason. And feel free to disagree. BBS is sometimes we use as kind of like doing the reading on Sunday morning where, you know, you do the reading, if you get good enough, then you can have a sermon. Well, we'd start young men out doing the BBSs, and then if they did good enough, we'd let them hold meetings. But I don't think that's the way to do it. I enjoy doing BBSs, and I can be criticized for doing too many, I guess. I only do 3 or 4 a year, but I thoroughly enjoy them. And then you have the thrill of marrying some of them that used to be in your BBS class, and maybe you had a small part in getting them off on the right foot. I don't regret any of that time, personally. Anybody want to comment on that? I got a little soapboxy there, and I don't apologize for it, I just feel that way. No, I know. I've had this discussion with others. So I know from whence you're coming. Now, I have had evangelists tell me that as they get older, they ease themselves out of BBSs because they don't feel like they relate to the young people very well. And when that happens, that's the wise thing to do. And maybe somebody needs to tell me that I don't, so I would. But it's a chemistry thing. Anybody else comment or question on that? I think I've lost track of where I'm at here. How to make evangelistic visits more productive. You know, there have been people that bash having the one-week meetings and say it's a waste of time. I can only tell you I disagree. It can be, but I disagree. Put yourself in the shoes of a congregation that's fairly small, fairly isolated. And it took me a long time to adjust to this. What a thrill it is for them to have any one of you, let alone me, any one of you come in and give them a kind of a breath of fresh air and a new insight. That's a real uplift for them. And so I, before I started doing it, I would have tended to say, well, a lot of these things are kind of a waste of time that I now see as very valuable components. And I hope that's not rationalizing my conduct. It's, I'm thrilled to listen. Because I don't get to listen very often. That's why I'm enjoying not this, but that. I get to listen. You get tired of hearing yourself. And small congregations get tired of no matter how good the teacher is, if the guy teaches every other week, you get a little tired of it. It's nice to have that uplift. So I think there's a real benefit. That's part of strengthening our existing congregations, in my humble opinion. Anybody else have a comment on anything we've discussed so far down through question 9? I see I'm going to have trouble getting back and doing question 7 justice, but I wanted to make sure we covered the evangelists to the extent you wanted to. I stuck in these last two. They weren't in my original, in what I was sent. What about evangelistic oversight? I put that in there because it has been in past decades kind of a hot button. I think it was probably 40, 50 years ago, maybe 30 years ago. There are frequent cases where it was probably abused or used wrong. And there was legitimate criticism of it. And at that case, and the Bible doesn't tell us how to do this, but there were evangelists then that might have 5, 6, 7 oversights. Well, logic tells me that that's probably too many just because the man was spread too thin. But I do believe the concept of evangelistic oversight, although it's not a biblical phrase, is a biblical concept. It's an evangelist having oversight of a group, either a new group that doesn't yet have officers, or a group that for some reason finds itself now without officers, be it through death or departure or whatever. And a congregation needs some guidance. It needs some authority. But the best evangelistic oversight is not as good as a good eldership. There is no way. An evangelistic oversight should always be viewed as temporary, and the primary goal of the evangelist who has evangelistic oversight is to work himself out of a job and get men qualified to be elders as soon as possible. Not prior to them being qualified, but to do it as soon as possible. God's plan is to have local leadership in the forms of a plurality of elders, not an evangelistic oversight. In congregations that have lost their officers, to me, evangelistic oversight is just kind of the lesser of two evils. It's not an optimum scenario, but having that congregation without any authority and any leadership is even less optimum, because who's going to guard them from the wolves and who's going to handle issues when they do come up? And what happens in those congregations is they do have leaders. They're just not officially called leaders. It's the people with the most dominant personalities who become the leaders. I don't have a whole lot to say on that, but I'll be happy to answer questions. I do think this evangelistic oversight is an area where, when geographically possible, it is good to have more than one evangelist involved. I can see a real advantage to having a plurality of evangelists involved, to give the attention to the group, and two heads being better than one. Do I think it's wrong if there's just one evangelist? No. Do I think it's sometimes better if there's more than one? Yes. I wrote down some notes on that one, too. Oh, caution to congregations. If you find yourself in a congregation that has evangelistic oversight, warn yourself not to get terribly comfortable with that, because God doesn't intend for you to get comfortable with it. God intends you to be striving toward having men qualified to be elders. If you're an evangelist now or in the future and have an oversight, one of your jobs, I believe, is to keep the congregation from getting very too comfortable with you. Because if you don't, they'll get comfortable with you, and it will decrease their motivation for developing themselves into elders. And if you've got a long-term evangelistic oversight, you're not too far from a one-man ministry system. Sometimes, and there are exceptions to this where there just aren't people qualified, but I do think if we're going to speak out strongly against one-man minister, we want to make sure we don't allow evangelistic oversight to become one-man minister under a name we're more comfortable with. And I don't have any place in mind when I say that, but if I was on the other side of the fence and you came to me and telling me how one-man minister is wrong, I would look for all the places where there is a longevity of evangelistic oversight and then ask you, now, what's the difference in a practical sense? Well, there are differences, but it's a hard thing to handle. And I don't know, I feel sorry sometimes for evangelists who are in oversight situations where they don't even seem to see much light at the end of the tunnel. And I don't have an answer for that. I feel bad if they're not there, and I feel bad if they're stuck there. So, any counsel you've got or any comments you want to make is just an unfortunate situation. I do know of some congregations that didn't want elders and didn't want oversight. Well, I think that's wrong. Now, to not have elders, that's not wrong. But to not want elders, that's wrong. If you don't have elders because you don't have men qualified, well, you do the best you can. But to not want elders because you don't want authority over you, or not want an evangelist because you don't want authority, it's that rebellion to authority that I think is troubling to me. Anybody care to comment on that? It's an important issue, and any of you that are evangelists or will become evangelists, your time in the barrel's coming. persuade? Well, I would probably start with Titus 1:5, where he's told to set things in order. We assume that that's new congregations, but I don't know that we can necessarily assume that. I think one of the jobs is to set things in order, and when a congregation finds itself without leadership, it's in need of some setting in order. But Wade does raise a valid issue in that the timing of the New Testament writings, we don't, you know, if the New Testament was written 150 years after the church was started, we'd have more examples of what happens when you lose your eldership. But the church was still fairly young, 30 years, maybe 40 years, when most of these epistles were written. So that's probably not the primary problem they were facing. Richard. How does an evangelist attain oversight? Well, the scripture is pretty silent on that. But my best judgment of that is the congregation would call that man in and ask him if he would be willing to work with them in that capacity. That's the way I am most comfortable. I'm not comfortable with an evangelist coming into town and getting down off of his horse and say, I'm here, I now have your oversight. I think it needs to be a calling. Elders and deacons are called out by the congregation. I think it's good to have the congregation call forth an evangelist. I wouldn't want to take the oversight of a group that didn't want one. So that's been the way I've asked congregations to approach it. And that needs to be the whole, you know, the collective congregation, not a unanimous. I've gotten calls from one person at a congregation. I'd like you to come and have oversight. Well, call the congregation together, discuss it, and let's see and if the congregation's of that mind, then call me back. But it's not a one-person decision. But we just have to use judgment there, because I don't know of a scripture that tells us just exactly how to handle that. But the principle of how an elder and deacon is called forth by the congregation seems to me a solid principle for an evangelist to be asked. Was that your hand, Brandon? Yeah, time and geography are two of them, although geography is becoming less of an issue just because of travel. But I think you ought to consider geography. Chemistry would be one. If I had a congregation where I just didn't feel like the chemistry of me and a significant number in that congregation would work, I would probably suggest they contact somebody else, and have done that. Well, I have done that not because of chemistry. The chemistry would be one of them, time, geography. Would there be any others? Those would be the ones that would come to mind.
Along the chemistry, you might be related to some of the
chemistry. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, Tom and I, we never discussed this, but we had a situation like that, and Tom now has the oversight there, and I think that's wise, because I happen to be related to some of the participants. Not that that would have been an issue, but why even cause it to be a possibility when it's not necessary? Is there a point at which you walk away? Well, let me rephrase that. Would there be a point at which I would walk away? Yes. If I thought that there was no interest in the congregation developing toward leadership, I would walk away. Or, if I felt that I could no longer be the effective person leading that congregation, in that latter case, I would recommend and try to turn it over to another evangelist. But I can conceive of a case where, for whatever reason, I'm just no longer effective there. And maybe it's chemistry, whatever, and I would turn it over to somebody else. Sure. Could my elders call me away? You bet they can. They can call me anytime they want. And that's something we haven't touched on. An evangelist is not a lone ranger. He is under the direction of his eldership. And everyone needs to understand that. When I'm in a congregation working that has elders, then I'm serving at the whim of the elders of that congregation, but if I do something inappropriate, if I teach falsely, then they need to tell my elders, who then retract and call me back and rebuke me. Absolutely. Yeah. But before I just left the congregation high and dry, I would do everything I could to either resolve it or get somebody else to work with me. Because whether it's an eldership, a deaconship, or an evangelistic thing, quitting is not the Lord's way. It's tempting, but it's not the Lord's way. And I doubt any elder that's been an elder very long hasn't thought about resigning. But they don't. And they shouldn't in most cases, because it's a crucial task. Anybody else have a question or a comment? Danger facing evangelists, and we've touched on these. Let me just give you a few that I wrote down here. Ambition. Well, that's a problem. Can be a problem for everybody. Pride, egotism. People are going to extol you when they should. And you can let that go to your head, or you can take it with a grain of salt. It's a matter of, I guess, maturity. This kind of goes along with that. I think in any leadership, you can get the idea that you're infallible. Well, hogwash. You're not infallible. The Bible is infallible, but not me and not you. You get the feeling maybe you're indispensable. It's laughable. Excessive elation or depression. And I don't know the cure for that, but in any church work, the more level you can stay, the better you're going to be, and probably the more productive you're going to be. And that is awfully hard. Because it's a series of elations and disappointments, and elations and disappointments. But it seems to me that effectiveness is somewhat proportional to learning how to balance those things out. Things are seldom as bad as you think, nor are they as good as you think. They're usually somewhere in between. And one of the things that's helped me is the church is going to go on irregardless of any specific congregation. I don't want to lose any soul. I don't want to lose any congregation. But even if a person leaves the church, you do everything you can, but the church is going to go on. And you move on. Easier said than done when your heart's broken. Compromise, that can always be a thing. Itching ears cause you to compromise. Slothfulness, I'm back to self-starter. Right? That can be a problem. But that can be a problem for any function in the church. You get a little lazy. You don't do it. I apologize a little bit for not getting to this dealing with grief. Maybe sometime we'll be able to do that. Maybe one of the other teachers can work it in. I will make only one comment about it. When I looked at that, I'm sure the intent was how to counsel people that have had somebody die and they're grieving. Let me just say, most grief has nothing to do with death. People that go through divorces grieve. People that have financial losses grieve. People that are sinful and remorseful grieve. So, as you think about that, it's not just consoling and counseling people that have lost a loved one. Grief is any time there's been a loss that interrupts our normal modus operandi, and that can be a broken relationship, a financial setback. Grieving takes all kinds, multiple things cause grief that I don't want to impinge upon your grief. Got just a couple of minutes if anybody has a comment or a question on the work qualifications of an evangelist. I encourage anybody who wants to consider it to consider it. But don't think of it as the only, nor automatically think of it as the best way to serve the Lord. In our brotherhood, it's the only office that we routinely financially support. I'm not sure that's good. because it may cause people to look toward the office of an evangelist for the wrong reason. And I'm not being critical, it's just human nature. Well, if I want to do full-time church work, I've got to be an evangelist. Well, I'm not sure you couldn't be a full-time elder or a full-time whatever. You know, why is that the only work? I understand why. It's because we want to stay away from the paid preacher or an elder usurping his authority, but I don't think it's unbiblical to think in those other terms. And if Paul was willing to make tents so that he could preach. One other thing, this is my soapbox. I meant to do it earlier so I wouldn't end on it, but I forgot. This is personal opinion. I think if a man is doing the work of an evangelist effectively, the support will be there. And he shouldn't have to go ask it. And I personally would resign as an evangelist rather than ask any congregation for money. That's just me personally. When I started this, I told Donna, I took about a 93% pay cut the first year. That doesn't mean I made a lot, it just means I made little. But we saved up, so we had 2 or 3 years. And I said, well, if the brotherhood doesn't respond, that means I'm not being productive, so I'll go get my job back or do something else. I believe that I have confidence in the brotherhood that they will support effective men in the world. And I also believe the brotherhood shouldn't support ineffective men in the world. I didn't mean to do that at the last, but I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just so dangerous. And I have found the brotherhood to be very responsive to men that are effective. And nobody likes to fire anybody. But it's not once an evangelist, always an evangelist. That's the way you get men in a work that they shouldn't be in. And that happened. Seldom addressed, but it happened.